The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good morning, folks. I've realised this week that I have been misquoting a very famous quote for years. Perhaps you've been misquoting it as well. It's a quote about power. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Do you notice that's slightly different to the way it's usually said? As far as I can research, Lord Acton, an English lord, wrote in a letter, 1887, and said that. Interesting quote, and I wonder if you believe that that's true, that power tends to corrupt. Found another one on the topic from Abraham Lincoln. Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power. I'm sure that's right. And one more slightly more modern quote. Robert Caro is an American journalist and writer who's written a number of books on the Lyndon Johnson presidency during the 60s. He says this: we're taught Lord Acton's axiom, all power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. I believed that when I started these books, but I don't believe it's always true anymore. Power doesn't always corrupt. Power can cleanse. What I believe is always true about power is that power always reveals. So if you want to know who someone is and what they're like, give them power. Perhaps that's why we're so reluctant to give anyone power in this country. Now, we've been working our way week by week through Matthew's Gospel. When you come to Matthew chapter 4, it's all about the implication of Jesus, as Matthew shows Jesus as the Son of God with power and authority. The question is, how will he use that power? What are the implications of him being the Son of God? And one of the other things I find interesting about this chapter is the only source of this chapter could be Jesus himself. The other major player in the story is probably not a reliable witness, if you know what I mean. But I suspect he'd have trouble getting through court or swearing on a Bible. So let's have a look at what it is that Jesus says about the implications of Jesus as the Son of God. What does that mean? What will that look like? How will he live that out? As we come to Matthew chapter 4, though, there's something I need to show you. I spoke about this last week, and it's a huge amount of material, but let me just see if you can get it. What Matthew is showing us as he unfolds the gospel is that Jesus has come to reform or remake the people of God. And Matthew deliberately shows a whole lot of parallels between Jesus' life and what Jesus does and the life of Moses and the beginnings of ancient Israel. So as we've quickly seen, Jesus is born under a tyrant, Herod the Great. Moses is born under a tyrant, Pharaoh. Both the tyrants are prepared to murder baby boys because of their paranoia. God brings Moses and Israel out of Egypt. We saw in Matthew chapter 2 that God brings Jesus after a time out of Egypt as a boy. Jesus is baptized in the Jordan River. Israel has crossed the Jordan River to come into the promised land. And the thing particularly today is this: Israel spends 40 years wandering in the desert, supposedly learning the lesson that they need to trust God and be obedient. The thing we see today is that Jesus spends 40 days in the desert learning the same lessons. So if you think 40 years in the desert and what they should have learned, and 40 days in the desert, Jesus fasting, that's the context. Last week, the end of chapter 3, you see God himself say Jesus as his son, and that's why I've started on your handout at Matthew chapter 3, verse 16. As soon as Jesus was baptized, he went up out of the water. At that moment, heaven was opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased." So Matthew's claim is that God himself, right, through his Spirit, has designated Jesus as, yes, the Son of God. But what are the implications of that? What will that look like as he lives it out? Well, chapter 4, verse 1. Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil. I won't spend too long on it, but you notice the New Testament, the Bible assumes that the devil is real, is a spiritual being bent on evil and destroying people, and up to a certain extent has power. as far as God allows him. He's there and he's real. The other thing to note, see in verse 1, the word tempted. In the original language, the word tempted, perasmos, can mean tempted or tested. Tempted or tested. There's two English words. As you think of though, tempted and tested are very close in meaning. And you really have to work out from the context whether to go with tempting or testing. They both apply in this story about Jesus. So out into the desert to be tempted by the devil. Now, where did this happen? The tradition is that it happened on the Mount of Temptation near Jericho. I saved this news clipping. I liked it. Legwork removed from spiritual path. Now, the good news is that some entrepreneurs in the Middle East have worked out, this was in the late 90s, worked out that it's too far to try and actually walk up to the Mount of Temptation. So they've built a... there's a monastery been there for centuries, and the monks are not particularly enthusiastic about this, as you can imagine. They built a cable car, the entrepreneur. So now in just 20 minutes, you can be zoop, whisked up to the top of the mountain. You can stay in a three-star hotel on the mountain. And the good news is you can eat at the Temptation restaurant, should you wish to. Isn't tourism a wonderful thing? Jesus doesn't get to eat at the restaurant, though. You see, chapter 4, verse 2, after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. So it's a way of humbling yourself, of being aware of your own mortality, and then the tempter or the tester comes to him, chapter 4, verse 3. The tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." There's a loaded phrase in there. See the one that I've highlighted in red, "If you are the Son of God." It's not so much prove that you're the Son of God. You could almost go with English as since you are the Son of God. Like, you're the Son of God, well, do this. Show us that you are. Now, the idea of making stones become bread. Oh, sorry, I should go back. That little phrase, if or since you are the Son of God, occurs three times in Matthew. Twice here in this story, and third time I'll show you in a moment. Very significant little phrase. Now, we see later in Matthew's Gospel, it's obvious Jesus could have done this, turned these stones into bread. He fed crowds of thousands with a packed lunch. His answer, 4 verse 4, Jesus answered, "It is written, man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God." Another sentence that's often misquoted, I think. Now, the significance of that. Let me show you. If you're used to the Old Testament, you'll know that Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible. Okay. If you're not used to it, let me give you a very quick tour. Moses writes the book of Exodus, which is about Israel escaping slavery and leaving Egypt. Then the book of Leviticus is all the rules, particularly the sacrificial system that God gave them and how they're to relate to him. The book of Numbers, essentially a travelogue and explaining why it is that they wandered around for 40 years in the desert when it's actually an 11-day journey back to the promised land. And in the book of Deuteronomy is Moses' big long sermon and address to the nation right on the edge of the promised land, telling them what they should have learnt from their time in the wilderness and what to remember in the land. Now, here's what's significant. Jesus answers these three temptations with quotations from Deuteronomy chapter 6 to 8, which are particularly about the lessons that the nation of Israel should have learned in the wilderness. So in their 40 years, they should have learned trust God, obedience, etc. Each of Jesus' quotes back to Satan is from those chapters. All right, well, let's actually have a look at the chapter. You see, his answer, man doesn't live on bread alone, but every word that comes from the mouth of God, very significant lesson to learn. It's actually a quote from Deuteronomy chapter 8. If you look over to the right-hand side of your page, it's there, or we can read it from the screen. It's about the fact that God fed them by manna each day in the wilderness. So Moses, okay, this is Moses addressing the people about what they should have learned in the 40 years in the desert. Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the wilderness these 40 years to humble and test you in order to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commands. He humbled you, causing you to hunger and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your ancestors had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Now, why is it that God chose to feed the thousands of people in the wilderness for years, day by day, with manna? There were other ways that he could have done it. You walk a herd of cattle into the camp and then they have dried meat that would last for weeks. Dried fruit, whatever. There'd be different ways. What it meant was manna, which comes from the Hebrew word for what is it, manna did not last. Except for the Sabbath, it went rotten overnight. So what that meant was that every night, except for the Sabbath, 6 days a week, the Israelites went to bed with an empty pantry. And what they were relying on is that in the morning, God would have kept his promise or his word and fed them. Now that would humble you, or it should, wouldn't it, day by day? And Jesus has learned that lesson. Now, I forget that lesson because my Kathy usually has approximately 2 or 3 years' food stored in the pantry and in the second fridge. And I'm not sure why it is that Asian people need 3 fridges, but it just comes with the... It's just the way it is. It's easy to forget. God did that so they would learn. Now, Jesus says he has learned that lesson. And, you know, it's interesting. In all of the miracles and all of the great things Jesus did, there's never anything done for himself. It's always for others. And he refuses here to use his power to serve himself. So, first temptation. The second temptation, in verse 5, and the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. Well, since you're the Son of God, he said, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands so that you will not strike your foot against a stone. Interesting, that's Psalm 91, and note the devil can quote the Bible quite well. Here's an artist's impression of what Herod's temple looked like at the time of Jesus. Massive. The court around the temple was the size of about a dozen football fields. It dominated the whole city. Josephus, the Jewish historian, says at one point the temple was 60 metres above the pavement below. And so throw yourself down looks like a great act of faith, doesn't it? You know, God says in the psalm he'll lift you up, and so do that. You know, Jesus' answer in verse 7, Jesus answered him, it's also written, do not put the Lord your God to the test. Once again, quoting that part of Deuteronomy chapter 6. There may be question of it, but to manufacture a situation that God has to rescue you from can look like faith, but it's actually the opposite. If you really have faith in someone, you trust what they've said. You don't put it to the test. And so what apparently is presented as an act of faith is actually the opposite. It's testing God's patience, and Jesus refuses to do it. You get to the third temptation in verse 8, and we're told, again the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. All this I will give you, he said, if you will bow down and worship me. Now here's what I guess is for many people, this is a strange thing to hear. The Bible calls the devil, or the evil one, the prince of this world. And I think what the Bible's saying is that God has actually given, to a limited extent that he has decided, God has actually given the devil or the evil one sway or control in our world. And it's a consequence of what we've done. It's God's judgment on our world, and so much of the pain and stuff that happens in our world comes from that. And there is a sense in which he can offer this to Jesus. You've got to say, this is real. Although, like all good lies, it's half true. Now, the promise, Jesus knows as the Son of God, the promise is that he will rule the world one day, that he will have all authority and power. And what's the temptation? And the gospel writers are saying this is a real temptation. The temptation is this, that you can have power and authority and glory, and you can have it the easy way. If you actually follow God's way, if he follows God's way, there will be great pain and great suffering, and it will truly cost. I have to say that this is a real temptation. Now, Jesus says no. You see in verse 10, Jesus said to him, away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only. Once again, quoting from that Deuteronomy passage about the 40 years in the desert. And we're told then the devil left him and angels came and attended him. But I put it to you, if you read the rest of Matthew's gospel, this this temptation or this pressure of being aware of the cost of living actually according to God's plan is in the background of Jesus' mind. He is aware of it. One place where you see it very clearly is in chapter 16, when the disciples, who are a little slow on the uptake, finally work out that he is the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God. So Peter, when Jesus says, "Who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And then Jesus begins to explain to them what that will cost him, what he's about to do. From that time on, verse 16:21, from that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hand of the elders, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day rise to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said, "this shall never happen to you." In other words, to suffer, to die? No, you're the one who's going to be in glory, not suffering and heartache. Verse 23, Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Now, I don't think Peter has become Satan. He's not in the red asbestos tracksuit with horns or any of that sort of thing. It's just that he is actually speaking with the temptation or the testing of the devil, that you need not suffer, that this is not necessary. And Jesus identifies that very strongly. You can tell it's a sore point. And it's to speak the way that people normally think. Minimize suffering, minimize difficulty, promote yourself. Now remember I said that little phrase, if you're the Son of God, is mentioned three times in Matthew's Gospel. Well, I believe already by chapter 4, Jesus understood where it would be mentioned the third time. And that is, above his head they placed the written charge against him, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Two rebels were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." So he knew what it would cost. And I haven't got time, but the struggle in the Garden of Gethsemane, when it really, really comes to the pointy end, he understands. Now, where does Matthew's Gospel finish? It finishes on a mountain, or the Gospel document finishes. So Jesus' ministry begins on a mountain with that tempting or temptation where he's offered all authority and power. And in chapter 28, it finishes with him saying he's been given all authority and power after the resurrection. So 28:16, then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations," etc., etc. And you see, he does have all authority. He does rule. He will return. But between those two mountains is that massive cost, and particularly the cross. And so it's the price that he pays to serve us as the Son. Now, in the last, I suppose, 200 years, something like that, maybe more, the deity of Jesus, the godness of Jesus that we saw at the end of chapter 1, has been under huge attack from outside the church, and if I could say inverted commas, from even inside the church and so on. As evangelicals have, I'll make a huge generalization here, but as evangelicals have attempted to defend the deity of Jesus, I think often we've underplayed the humanity of Jesus. And you can get this picture of Jesus as if he was somehow made of Teflon or stainless steel and he kind of just floated along and nothing was a problem. And yet, as you read the Gospels, you feel his humanity come through. Chapter 4, and as you pick up this theme through Matthew, for example. But I wonder, have you ever thought, if you've read the New Testament, how hard it was for him? His family didn't believe him. His family patronized him. And at one stage, they turn up to take him home for a long rest because they think he's gone insane. His constant conflict with the religious leaders and of the nation as they try and trap him in his words. There's an endless flood of sick people coming to him, so much that, many times he can't even eat or he can't get a day off. He looks over Jerusalem, the city that he loves, and he weeps for it because he knows what will happen as they've rejected him. He's betrayed by a friend and abandoned by others and then ultimately unjustly crucified. It's hard. He's human. Now, what difference does that make? Well, the New Testament writers pick up the idea of Jesus as, yes, God and man, and yet has been there and understand what it is that we go through. And so if you're a Christian and a follower of Jesus, the one that you follow is not distant and uninvolved. He's, if you like, he's been here, he's done this, he's lived our life. The book of Hebrews is written to, is one of the New Testament letters, is written to Hebrew or Jewish Christians who have begun to follow Jesus, and now it's beginning to cost, if you like, it's beginning to bite. And the temptation is for them to drift back into Judaism because it'll be easier, softer, more comfortable. And the Hebrews is saying, no, 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 keep going. Keep going. Jesus is better. You notice what they say about Jesus understanding the temptations or difficulties that we have. He says this, for we do not have a high priest, meaning Jesus who represents us. We do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses. But we have one who's been tempted in every way, or tested in every way, just as we are, and yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, meaning pray, come to him, ask him with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. If you struggle with tempting or testing, which I do regularly and fail regularly, but as you pray to God, Jesus represents us. Jesus knows what we go through. He's been here. He understands. And so I began talking about power. What you see in chapter 4 is the beginning of that theme of the fact that Jesus will use his power, the fact that he's the Son of God, to serve and to care for others. And to follow Jesus is to do that also. But the word follow means that he has been there first and has done this and lived it out. There may be questions, comments. First question, do you agree with Lord Acton? Power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Yes. There is a bumper sticker around that says all power corrupts and absolute power sounds like great fun. I agree with that. And those who frame our constitutions and our laws also agree with it. And that's why we limit the power of people in this country. Should we all be fasting and going on retreat, especially at this time of the year? That's an interesting question. I think yesterday was Ash Wednesday, wasn't it? I think I saw people walking around. If you're a follower of Jesus, and if fasting helps you in following Jesus and in serving him and in knowing him better, absolutely. But it seems to me that Jesus makes, or the New Testament makes fasting, etc., optional. But it has hit the idea of retreats, and it has hit me lately that I run on the treadmill so hard and so fast, a little bit of time away to think and pray and stuff would probably be good for me as well. Need to talk to my boss about that. Does following Jesus mean that we will suffer? Is that the main way we learn about God and how to practice our faith? Oh, good question. I think Jesus does guarantee that if we follow him at some time, there will be difficulties and it will cost again and again and again. Now, it doesn't mean you go looking for it, but Jesus says if we follow him, live his way, name his name, it'll come for us. Right? We'll get it. Now, depending on where you are in the world and what century and where we live, I think in Australia we have it pretty good, but inevitably there'll be difficulties because of following him. Is that the main way? I think particularly the book of 1 Peter says that God will use difficulties and hard things in the lives of those who follow Jesus to mould them and shape them. think it's obvious the easy things in life, they're good, they're fun, but they don't change us or mould us very much. And so it's the difficult things, the hard things, the things that test faith that mould us and shape us. So I think, yes, it is the main way that we learn, unfortunately. So God will put, if you're a Christian and follow Jesus, God will put hard things into your life, not because he's cranky with you or doesn't love you, but because he loves you and because it's his plan to mould you and change you and shape you. So, for example, the way you learn compassion for other people is very often that you've suffered and had heartache yourself, and you learn compassion. The way you learn wisdom is through difficulties. The way you learn patience is God makes you wait for things. It's just the way life works, I think. Matthew 4, verse 5, the devil took him to the holy city. What's the Hebrew word translated as took? Sounds like as if Jesus is under the direction of the devil. Yeah, Matthew's gospel is written in Greek, in Koine Greek, which just meant common Greek. If you picked up Matthew's gospel as a Greek speaker, it would be like picking up the Daily Telegraph, I guess. 4 verse 5, paralambano, the devil took him. A completely ordinary word. I don't think it's indicating that the Jesus went against his will or whatever. Jesus seems to be cooperating in these three things and saying no. So you notice it's the Spirit of God has taken him to this. So in the book of Hebrews chapter 2, it says that it was necessary for Jesus to live through these things to become the perfect Saviour. I think what it means is that he, as humanity's representative, struggled with and was tempted with the same things that humanity is tempted with. So the word took, no, just a completely ordinary word. Is it significant that Jesus names the devil Satan in Matthew 4:10? Maybe, but it seems to me that sometimes the devil and Satan are used interchangeably. Satan, the two words mean different things, and Satan is the accuser, and someone help me here. Satan means the accuser, and the devil, diabolos, is... Sorry? Thank you. Father of lies. So they're just slightly different meanings to those names, but it seems to me the New Testament uses them interchangeably. Okay. Can the accounts of these temptations be understood as different approaches to his coming ministry? Not sure. There's the temptation to serve himself and how he'll use his power, and the cost of following God's plan, I think, are the main agendas. The two of the other Gospels, Mark only gives one or two verses to this. It's just not in Mark's particular agenda. Luke gives the same length account, and Luke changes the order of the temptations. Luke has the standing on the temple one as the last of the three. So the gospel writers have a certain liberty in how they present material to fit with their agendas. Does Matthew 4:1 assume that the devil has a physical dimension? I'm not sure that we can tell from the text. Certainly, different times he can appear and... Now, I'm not sure that I can answer that. Does the devil now have the power he apparently had at the time of Jesus to give devil worshippers kingdoms? Now, that's an interesting question. The folk... The clock's not going to save me on this one, is it? The focal point of Jesus' work is to destroy the works of the devil and to set people free. And what the book of Hebrews will say is that what it is that gives the devil his power is our guilt before God. So it's our guilt before God that we break his laws, that God's a God of justice, and that guilt that hangs over us is what gives the evil one his power. And the death of Jesus is about paying that guilt wiping that away and so setting us free. Okay. The great work of the devil is the lie. In John chapter 8, Jesus calls him the father of lies. And so, if you like, there's a superficial work of the devil that I've heard from missionaries and people who've worked in other cultures. You've got witch doctors and all that. All the stuff in the movies about heads spinning around and green vomit or whatever, that's all superficial. The great deep work of the devil is the lie that God cannot be trusted. And if you want to understand that, you look at Genesis chapter 3, in this beautiful, simple kind of almost parable, or something, when the evil one comes to the man and the woman and he says, God's holding out on you. God isn't truly good. He doesn't really want what's best for you. God isn't truly wise. He doesn't know what's best for you. And if you disobey him and make your own rules, you can become like God. Now, that's the great lie that people, we, our society keeps believing again and again and again and again. Now, that's why Jesus says the truth will set you free. So does Satan have power at the moment? Well, at one level, yes. He deceives the nations of the world. At another level, his back is broken. Jesus has paid that price. And people, to become a Christian is to leave one kingdom, the kingdom of the evil one, and believing those lies, and actually come into the light, or, as Jesus says, the kingdom of God. Could the devil really have offered this to Jesus? I think you've got to say yes. There's no indication in the text that it's not a genuine temptation to him. The mechanics of it, I don't know. Do you want to go and ask? Okay. That's all the questions. There might be follow-up.
That last one.
Yeah, I think that was just a terrible mess of a rant, that one, of a rave. Yeah.
You've answered me by saying the work of the devil is in lies and guilt of the individual. But if you look at, say, the book of Revelation, you have a connection there between the work of the devil and the kingdoms of this earth.
Yes.
Revelation 13, that kind
yes.
of stuff. So the rising up of different powers and that kind of stuff. So you acknowledge, you allow for that as well.
Yes. Interesting that... Yeah, so the work of the devil, as the New Testament describes, is not just in terms of the individual person, but in terms of the world and the kingdoms of the world. Revelation paints things with a fairly broad brush, but it's the idea that the devil raises up false teachers about religion, governments that demand worship, all that kind of thing. The idea is being to oppose God and everything in it and to mislead people. And so there's multi-layers to that. At the same time, the Bible paints the devil as powerful and real, and yet, like a dog on a lead, can only go as far as God allows, and God will ultimately see it all, him totally destroyed, and God's even able to use what he does to bring about his purposes. So it's the fascinating thing about the devil is this. The Bible tells us just enough to know what it is that he does and to tell him to see that and to stay away from it. There's all sorts of questions about the devil that we'd like to know that we don't. A lot of what we as a society believe about the devil actually comes from John Milton's poem Paradise Lost, written in the 1600s. It's hard sometimes to sort out what was in there compared to what the Bible actually says. You get hints in the Bible, but there's lots of questions that we'd like to know that you just don't get the answer. It just says, he's there, he's real, here's what he does, stay away from it.
Tends to be in the detail, isn't it, Al?
Yes, yes.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.